Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Jim Tonkowicz, an interesting cat indeed. After spending more than two decades in the Presbyterian ministry, Mr. Tonkowicz decided to move over to Catholicism, a process that is detailed in his e-book, How Not to Become Catholic. This will be today's topic of discussion. But converting to Catholicism isn't the only thing he's been doing. His career spans stints in youth ministry, secular business, nonprofit management, writing, and public speaking. Most recently, after managing Chuck Colson's daily radio commentary, Breakpoint, Jim served as president of the Institute on Religion and Democracy. He is now freelancing and doing a variety of projects with groups such as the Heritage Foundation, the Diocese of Arlington, the Archdiocese of Washington, the Colson Center, and Wyoming Catholic College, where he is the special advisor to the president for strategic initiatives. He writes a weekly column at ChristianHeadlines.com and recently published the book The Liberty Threat, The Attack on Religious Freedom in America Today, endorsed by a former guest on this show, Tom Farr. Religious liberty is one of our favorite topics on the show, and if time allows, we will ask Jim to give some of his thoughts on that subject. But if we don't quite get to that point, you can track down his books and other writings at our website, as well as our Facebook fan page, so please visit. Jim, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you very much.
Today's topic of converting to Catholicism is of great interest to me, since I thought that for the last five centuries or so, it's been the Protestants that were luring away the Catholics. And that has been my own personal experience, having grown up Irish and Polish Catholic and now evangelical Christian. But in recent years, I'd noticed a number of people, many of them prominent people, moving in the opposite direction. So it seems like the Counter-Reformation is finally paying off. My direct question to you, though, is, did Tom Farr make you do it? I mean, he has a lot of political sway out there in D.C.
Well, but it's certainly true that when I was working for Chuck Colson at Breakpoint, Chuck had lots of Catholic friends, and he prayed with them, he worked with them, he did thinking with them, he wrote with them, he invited them to his conferences, they invited him to their conferences, and working with Chuck, I got to know a lot of his Catholic friends, and that was, that was in fact, a factor. You know, people like Tom Farr, Robert George, Jay Buzyshevsky, professor of philosophy and political science at the University of Texas, Austin. People who did at some point come into the church, and that certainly was a factor. I mean, certainly Tom didn't make me do it, but I realized that it was a well-trod path. And of course, it's been a well-trod path for some time. Think of course, John Henry Newman, who came into the Catholic Church in the mid-1800s, and talked about many of the issues I think that are very much alive today. G.K. Chesterton, novelist. Robert Hugh Benson, whose father was the Archbishop of Canterbury, Monsignor Benson, I don't think it's new news, but I think that there's a lot more. I think it's a lot more porous at this point, partly because it's a lot easier at this point. In the 1800s in England, particularly, or the 1800s in the United States, to cross the Tiber was huge and scandalous and, scandalous beyond your church. It was scandal, public scandal even. And it's, of course, it's much less so today.
Well, before we get to the big reveal of why you crossed the Tiber and moved to Rome there, metaphorically speaking, let's go back and start at the beginning, because all of this has deep roots. And tell us about your own background growing up, family life, religious background, schooling.
Family life. All of my grandparents were immigrants from White Russia, from Belarus. They came to this country, and they were Russians. They were Russian Orthodox. My mom and my dad were both born here. I have one brother who passed away about 6 months ago. And we grew up going to the Russian Orthodox Church. And, I have memories of little bags of raisins and quiet cars and people chanting in a language that wasn't even Russian, in Church Slavonic. And I guess you could say that, or the way I put it is, I learned the data of the Christian faith in the Orthodox Church and in Sunday school. The doctrine of the Trinity, the deity of Christ, the incarnation, the atoning sacrifice of the cross, the resurrection from the dead. I don't ever remember hearing about the second coming of Christ, but I probably did. So, I learned all of that in church, going to the Russian Orthodox Church. I went away to prep school when I was 13. I went to boarding school at the Choate School in Connecticut. We lived in New Jersey at the time. And I was sort of going along, and sometime in my junior year, I just felt like I wanted to get more involved in things. I was going to class and doing my sports and sort of doing what I had to do, and I just wanted to connect. And when I was a freshman, I somehow got this idea in my head that every educated person should read the Bible, and I had really never read the Bible growing up. So I went down to the bookstore and charged a Bible to my parents and brought it back to my room, and I started reading from the beginning, just like any other book, and I probably got to Genesis 3 or 4 and decided I'd become an educated person some other day.
you didn't quite make it up to Numbers, did you?
No. So I heard that our chaplain, who I liked, was holding a Bible study at his residence, and I had a Bible, so off I went, and thoroughly enjoyed it. And it was what is typically called inductive Bible study. He was asking questions, and we were reading the text and learning. Somebody gave me some Scripture Union Bible study notes, and I started using those, reading the Bible myself every day, a little bit at a time. And then I was invited to a ski weekend put on by a group called FOCUS, Fellowship of Christians in Universities and Schools, which continues to be a ministry to kids at prep schools. I was invited to their Skis and Skeptics weekend.
Oh, Skis and Skeptics. What does that mean?
Well, it was right there in your face. It was an outreach weekend, and it happened, I believe, in February. It happened in February. Yeah, it was over Valentine's Day, up in New Hampshire near Lake Sunapee. So I had learned to ski the year before, and so that was a big draw. It was an all-boys school, and there would be girls. So,
yeah.
And I had my Bible, and I was going to Bible study, and I had friends who were going. And what happened at Skis and Skeptics, I didn't learn anything new at Skis and Skeptics. I did break a pair of skis, and I did meet my first real girlfriend. The other thing that happened is one of the speakers, well, to use an analogy that I heard years later, have you ever tried to put a jigsaw puzzle together without the box top?
Oh, yeah.
You know, so you don't know what the picture is. Mm-hmm. Well, it's confusion. It's all these pieces, and they go together somehow. But as soon as you have the box top, you can say, oh, the red ones go over here, the blue ones go over here. This speaker gave me the box top by saying it's not about knowing information about God. It's about knowing God through faith in Jesus Christ. And I had just simply never heard that before. But I heard it, and I said, oh, well, that's the thing that's the box top. That makes the data meaningful. That makes the data intelligible. And really had a very strong conversion experience at that point. A year later at Skeez and Skeptics, I picked up a copy of a book entitled Called to the Ministry by Edmund Clowney. Clowney was the president of Westminster Theological Seminary at the time. And read that book and said, yep, this is what I want to do.
Mm.
So that was when I was a senior at prep school.
Okay. And you chose Presbyterianism. Why?
Well, not initially.
Yeah, okay.
Not initially. My prep school was not a church school, but kind of everybody was Episcopalian. Mm-hmm. The ministry of focus was non-denominational, but everybody was an Episcopalian. When I got to college, I hooked up with the InterVarsity group immediately and tried to go to an Episcopal church. And I was at Bates College in Lewiston, Maine. And the Episcopal churches were fairly out in la-la land theologically, and I, even at that age I could tell. And two, they really weren't interested in having college students come, or at least they didn't appear to be. So I ended up going to an Orthodox Presbyterian church for a while, and then we all went to a Missouri Synod Lutheran church from our group.
Can I just stop and ask, because this I have a little reflection that I want to share a little bit later.
Sure.
But the Episcopalian church that you went to in Maine, you said, no, they didn't seem to want to welcome college students. Was there a big age gap there that you had parents maybe with little kids and then everybody else was 80 and above?
That's what I remember, but it's been a long time.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the sort of thing I remember. Yeah.
Go ahead. Continue.
I went to Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary. I got my master's there, and later I got a doctor of ministry there. And I came in, and they had denominational meetings once a month. And so I went to the one that said, you know, non-denominational. And the professor who was leading the meeting said, find a denomination.
Well, that makes it easy. It's kind of almost sounds like a little trap there. I would go to a non-denominational one. They said find a denomination.
Well, I ended up just sort of following my nose church-wise and went to Park Street Church in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I was during the time I was, the 4 years I was in seminary. I crammed 3 years into four. I met my wife there. We were married there. I was involved in ministry there. I interned there. Still have friends from Park Street days, including Marcus Grodi, who runs the Coming Home Network on EWTN, the Catholic television station.
Ah, so was he a Presbyterian then too?
He was.
Okay.
Yes.
We're going to
hang on. I wasn't. The Park Street Church was a congregational church.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
And I actually was licensed as a congregational minister. Well, after I left seminary, I just didn't get a job in ministry. And I did this and that and went to this church and that church. And eventually I got a job working for this group, Focus, ministering in the boarding schools in New England. And we're attending a congregationally governed church, a Baptist church, actually. And I left seminary not believing there was any biblical polity, that the churches used whatever was there. You know, the ones that were basically Jewish had presbyters. The ones that were basically Gentile had episcopoi, bishops or overseers. And that there was no biblical polity, and these things just sort of came up. And increasingly, my experience told me that congregational polity was not wise. I had seen too many insane situations, largely because the church was independent. I had seen ministers do things largely because every minister was independent. And I said, okay, well, if I get ordained here in Connecticut, and then I move to Arizona, who's in charge of me? Who's responsible for me? Who has authority over me? And the answer is kind of nobody. And I said, well, that doesn't make sense. And it was at that point that I you know, I started to see more of the connections within the churches, even in the New Testament, and ended up in the Presbyterian Church in America, the PCA, and was eventually ordained there, and became a pastor of a church out in Silicon Valley in California.
Okay, I have to just stop and mention that's a very interesting observation that the congregational polity can lead to a lot of variegated outcomes, I would guess.
Variegated, yes, yeah. That's a good word.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, churches that were in deep trouble, and there was no one for them to turn to. There was nobody responsible for them, and there was nobody that they were answerable to. I think it is problematic. I mean, I have lots of friends who are Baptists and Free Church evangelicals, but I think there are some real problems with that kind of polity.
Well, it makes sense then that the early seeds might have been planted for you moving to a more Episcopal type of polity, and I think we're getting there.
Well, eventually, having particularly read the Church Fathers, it occurred to me that beginning in the early second century, you had bishops and presbyters and deacons, and you had this Episcopal polity that was already there. And I said to myself, well, okay, well, if the Bible, therefore the apostles, taught Presbyterian polity, how is it after the last apostle died, the church did this massive reorg and that never shows up in any literature, mm-hmm. and became oriented around bishops and dioceses? And the answer is that's not a viable explanation for having bishops in the second century. Mm-hmm. You had to have had them from the very beginning, mm-hmm. And that was really my thinking that moved me to belief in an Episcopal polity.
Well, tell us about your time in a more hierarchical institution, the Presbyterian Church. You were a minister in Presbyterian Church for about 20 years. Discuss that.
I was ordained out in California at Peninsula Hills Presbyterian Church. Well, I was ordained by the Presbytery of Northern California. And the church was a startup church. It was 5 years old when I arrived. And it was a wonderful group of people. You know, as a pastor, I, in some ways, I couldn't have asked for a better group of people. Cooperative, encouraging, deep love for Christ. It was kind of an unusual church. We took stock of the, we had a church band. We did mostly contemporary music. And sort of in keeping with the character of the church, our pianist was finishing a PhD in business. Our drummer had a PhD in chemistry. Our bass guitar player also had a PhD in chemistry. I was a guitar player. I had a doctor of ministry. Our other guitar player had a PhD in physics. It's like, wow.
Yeah, and they say
unusual place.
I know, and they say church people are not that smart, huh? That's the church of the PhD, I think. Okay.
We had enough physicists that they could have had their own small group.
There you go.
Yeah, it was quite amazing. You know, loved the church, but I found that, and this is just on a vocational level, I started to get bored very quickly. Now, I was still working on when I arrived, I was still working on my doctorate, and that kept things fresh. But when that was finished, I just felt like I was on a treadmill. And, you know, Sunday was always coming and always coming and always coming. And, while I love to study the scriptures, and I mean, I still study the scriptures in the original languages, and I love to teach the scriptures. I enjoyed preaching very much. I also found that there were all sorts of things that I was interested in. And so after some rather serious career counseling, we moved back to D.C. with the idea of being involved one way or another in the think tank policy idea world of Washington, and spent some time in a a startup computer company, oddly enough, and then was hired by Chuck Colson. And I love Breakpoint because we talked about everything.
Let me ask you about that experience as a Presbyterian minister out there in California. How long did that last?
I was there about 7.5 years.
7.5 years. That's clergy years, which is kind of like dog years. Those can be pretty long. And I know that the ministry actually has a high level of professional burnout. You carry a lot of burdens of the people in your congregation. And as you mentioned as well, that the boredom can set in because the intellectual excitement from seminary gets turned over to these day-to-day bureaucratic decisions of how to run the church and, you know, get everybody together for choir practice and all that kind of stuff. Was that your experience? Was it just, you know, moving from seminary, the intellectual stimulation there, just to the day-to-day grind of the church, did that weigh heavy on you? And have you experienced other people that have had that experience?
I think it was partly that. Seminaries, not that seminaries aren't already teaching, you know, don't have their plates full to the ceiling with things to teach people. Seminaries need to do a little bit better on things like, you know, basic bookkeeping, you know, how to write a budget, how to use Excel. I mean, these are all things that were new. And but there is the day-to-day running of the church. There's the day-to-day, you know, today I do my scripture study, tomorrow I read the commentaries, the next day I better start writing. And, you know, it is a week-in, week-out grind, you know, punctuated by things like funerals and weddings. But, there was a level of burnout. And frankly, the being a solo pastor, which most ministers in this country are, most Protestant ministers, there's a real loneliness that sets in.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though I had and still have friends that were in the church, and this is going back 15 years now, I had good friends at that church. You know, in any group, one of these things is not like the others, and it's always you because you're the pastor.
Yeah.
You know, things don't start without you. You know, you have to be there to, you know, to say the prayer. I was part of clergy groups and our presbytery. You know, we would spend time together, and we had a group that spent time together even beyond presbytery meetings. But still, there's a real loneliness that goes with the clergy, and I think that's a real challenge for me, and I think it's a real challenge for a lot of ministers.
Yeah, something that's been echoed by several of our other guests in a number of other podcasts. We've talked with pastors, and this always comes up. You know, seminary training never really prepares us for the day-to-day grind, and the issue of loneliness and being separate and different than everybody else becomes very difficult. We'll point some people back to some of those podcasts. But
well, I think that I was when I was out there, I was talking to an Episcopal priest friend of mine, and he said something about pastoral formation. I'd never heard that phrase before, but I knew immediately what he was talking about. And the Episcopalians do it a bit better. The Catholics do it extremely well, which is you have to train someone spiritually and psychologically to be in this odd role. And I think that in my seminary education, and I think that there was at least a tacit assumption that would just sort of happen, or that wasn't necessary, or I don't know what. But I think within seminary education, there's a real need to, I used to say in premarital counseling, my goal here is to take not all the mystery out of life, but a lot of the mystery out of life. I think the same thing needs to happen for would-be pastors.
Interesting observation there that, again, dovetails with some of the things that other folks have talked to us about. But now we are back in D.C. You're working with Chuck Colson's Breakpoint, And as you mentioned in the early part of the podcast, you're starting to come in contact with some of these folks called Catholics. And how is the transition now toward Catholicism starting? Is it it's still not there? Are you still going to a Presbyterian church? What's going on here?
Yeah, I was attending, well, I was a member of Presbytery, attending a Presbyterian church. My son, we have one son, he was very involved in the youth ministry there, and a number of things happened. I never had the time or interest or energy for Catholic bashing. You know, and in fact, I was pretty oblivious to it all. I had too many friends that were Catholic. I have relatives who are Catholic. You know, I had benefited too much from Catholic authors and Catholic scholarship. Even when I was a pastor in California, my spiritual director was a Catholic. I didn't go in for this sort of thing. Well, being new to the presbytery here on the East Coast, I had to be examined by presbytery. And the chairman of our candidates committee threw me a softball question. He said, well, if somebody comes to your church wanting to join and he's been baptized as a Catholic, would you rebaptize him? And I kind of gave the standard answer because, you know, by then I'd been around Presbyterianism long enough to know the standard answer, with a comic flourish at the end. I said, no, I would not rebaptize him. He was baptized with water in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. I wouldn't rebaptize him. If someone was coming in from a liberal Protestant church, however, I'd want to ask some questions just to make sure they weren't baptized with milk and honey in the name of the parent, the child, and the second cousin. Mm-hmm. And instead of howls of manly laughter, you know, there was this explosion. About how the Catholic Church is no church and Catholic baptism is not Christian baptism. And it's like, where did this come from? And, you know, instead of a quick 7 to 10 minute get them in, get them out, congratulations, you're a member of the presbytery, this thing went on for over an hour where I was trying to justify my existence. The result of the kerfuffle was my coming into the presbytery was delayed a couple of months. And so all's well that ends well, but something happened in me. Something was just knocked a little bit off kilter. Something was reoriented. And it was fairly minor. I didn't run out and buy a copy of the Catechism of the Catholic Church. But there were questions partly, why are these people so angry?
Mm-hmm.
Partly, you know, wait a minute, what do Catholics really believe? And that kind of lodged in the back of my brain. And again, with Colson, I mean, I don't want to be name-dropping, but, you know, because I knew Colson, I got to know people like theologian Michael Novak, Robbie George, Russell Hittinger, and so on. I got to know these Catholic thinkers. I got to know Jay Bujaszewski before he became a Catholic and then knew them afterwards. Richard John Newhouse. And these were very, not only were they very intelligent people, I mean, scary smart people, they had clearly had a lively faith in Jesus Christ, which they talked about in the same way I talked about my faith in Jesus Christ. So these questions were sort of bubbling. And in the meanwhile, one of my best friends and his family, David and Joanne and their son William at the time, became Catholics. So that was kind of in the back of my mind as well. A couple of things happened kind of simultaneously.
Let me break in here a minute because I'm curious about your discussion with the church authority leader when you were getting into the presbytery. About what year was this? You can give us approximate decade. Was this mid-80s, mid-90s?
Oh, no, this would have been, yeah, exactly. This would have been, the fall of 1999?
Well, see, that's fascinating because we hear about lots of anti-Catholicism discussion back in the 1800s, but to be thinking that we're seeing the echoes of that as late as just 15 years ago is pretty amazing.
Well, and let me, to be fair, it was two of the brothers in Presbytery. I mean, it was two guys tag-teaming each other, and a lot of people who later apologized to me for remaining silent. So, you know, I mean, the PCA, the Westminster Confession that the PCA uses, all of the Whore of Babylon stuff has been pulled out. I mean, you know, the PCA has, you know, I think culturally does not have that edge. It was a couple of characters within the room who dominated the conversation. But as I said, it was enough to put me off for a month or two, whatever it was, and caused me to start asking some questions.
Okay, so now you have that experience. Questions are starting to circulate in your head. You're meeting all these folks, Mike Novak, Chuck Colson, Robbie George. Your friends are moving back to the Catholic Church. What's going on with you now?
Well, one of the things that I started to ask when I was working for Chuck, and really the big question, was how do you maintain even a modicum of biblical orthodoxy within a postmodern era if you don't have an authoritative church? And that became a big question for me. So that's happening kind of intellectually. On the other side of it, I mentioned my friends David and Joanne and their son William. Their son and my son are the closest thing. Now, we grew up together. They've been best buddies since they were 3 years old, and they're now 30. William was going to school, was a year ahead of my son in school, and he chose to go to Thomas Aquinas College in California, which is a small, very Catholic, great book school. My son, partly because he wanted to go to school with William, something that we supported, partly because he learns the way Thomas Aquinas teaches, that is, it's entirely read the book and come to a seminar. All classes are run that way. Mm-hmm. He decided he wanted to go to Thomas Aquinas College. He also liked the idea that it was a very orderly, no drugs, no alcohol, no girls and boys dorms, no boys and girls dorms. He really liked that idea, a kind of environment. And so my son went to what I called at the time an industrial strength Catholic college. Mm. So he brought home two things. He brought home questions. And two, he brought home fellow students. And quite honestly, their witness to their faith and the strength of their faith was moving. Not necessarily the academic questions, but you know, these were kids who were just solidly Christian, solidly established in Jesus Christ, and very Catholic. My wife and I, there was one weekend where, you couldn't walk downstairs without stepping on a Thomas Aquinas student. The house was full of them. And, Sunday morning, early, my son said, everybody wants to go to Mass at the Basilica, in downtown Washington. Mm-hmm. And my wife looked at me, I looked at her and said, well, can we come too?
Sure.
And so we went. And two things I remember. One, killer sermon, great sermon. And two, while in missions conferences for years, I had talked and sung about worshiping with the nations. Let's be honest, all the churches I went to were full of college-educated white people. This was worshiping with the nations. I was absolutely overcome with the Catholicity of the Church, and it was right there on display at this Mass, and it was quite amazing. So anyway, these questions about the Catholics and what do Catholics believe and what do Protestants believe and why there's a difference. My son's asking these questions, and I'm having conversations with him and with his friends. So that's certainly going on. And then about that time, I moved from working for Colson to being president of the Institute on Religion and Democracy. And the IRD focuses on, or focused at the time, on the mainline Christian churches, what Richard Newhouse used to call the mainline, old line, sideline Christian churches, and sadly enough, increasingly sideshow. The Episcopal Church, the Presbyterian Church USA, the United Methodist Church, and some on the United Church of Christ and ELCA Lutherans. And so as a result, I went to their various assemblies. And there was one summer when I went to the PCUSA General Assembly, the Episcopal Church General Conference, and then my own PCA General Assembly. And flying from Ohio to Atlanta after the Episcopal Church General Conference, I was reading, honestly, I'm not making this up, I was reading Abraham Kuyper, the Dutch Reformed theologian, talking about Protestantism and the individual conscience before God and so on, and a conversation broke out in the seat behind me. Two women who didn't know each other and realized they had both been at the Episcopal General Conference as volunteers. And it was the conference where they elected Catherine Jeffer Shorey presiding bishop. And one saying to the other, oh gosh, were you there when they elected Catherine Jeffer Shorey? Oh yes, I was there. Couldn't you just feel the spirit? Oh yes, I felt the spirit. You could feel the spirit. And I'm like, oh, Catherine Jeffer Shorey has a theology that is only mildly Christian. That has been clear throughout her tenure. And so, but we felt the spirit. Well, you know, I mean, here's the individual conscience before God, but untethered. Untethered by the scripture, untethered by the teachings of the church. This giant subjective experience, what Blessed John Henry Newman called private judgment. And it's private judgment that he saw happening even in the mid-1800s, but that infects these mainline churches. You know, they get together, make space for dialogue, emote, vote, and there's the new Revised Standard Version of God's will. So I'm flying to the PCA General Assembly, and I said to myself, all right, well, what's keeping us from doing all the same kinds of things, redefining the Trinity, arguing that in favor of same-sex marriage and the ordination of gays and lesbians and transsexual people, what's keeping us from doing all that? And in the final analysis, I think the answer is the goodwill of a converted clergy. I said, well, that's really not good enough these days. And so this, this is a big question. Now, meanwhile, because of my board at the IRD, I'd also gotten to know, and again, I apologize for what I'm sure sounds like name dropping, but I got to know George Weigel. And George gave me a stack of books to read, I read his book, some of his books, including Letters to a Young Catholic and his biography of John Paul II. And then some theology books and books on how Catholics do theology that he had recommended. And again, my spiritual directors were Catholics at the time. And so all of this, you know, coming to my conclusions about bishops in the early church. So there's all this sort of intellectual stuff that's going on. My son, after graduating from Thomas Aquinas College, did in fact enter the Catholic Church, and he's now vice president for external affairs at Wyoming Catholic College. He got married to a wonderful classmate of his. While I was at the IRD being president, there were times when I felt like I simply need to get out of my office before my head explodes. And I suspect that's the experience of most people who are presidents of organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And the office was a couple of blocks away from St. Matthew's Cathedral, the Catholic cathedral in Washington, D.C. And I would go there just for quiet reflection, prayer, come back to my office feeling refreshed after a half hour or so. And it's a cathedral. It's a big place. And one day I realized that every time I walked into that church, I would wind my way past hundreds of seats and sit in pretty much the same pew every time. And I said, why am I doing this? And I realized that I was sitting in front of the tabernacle. I was sitting in front of the presence of Jesus, physically present in the Eucharist. And that really sealed it for me. That really sealed it for me. I also had the experience of going to an Anglican church and walked in, sat down, kneeled down, prayed, sat back down in the pew, and I had this sudden feeling of panic that something was very wrong. And what's wrong? What's wrong? And I realized there was no tabernacle. There was no Blessed Sacrament there. And then when I realized that, I said, oh, and I relaxed, and that sense of panic was over. But, there were all the intellectual questions. I dealt with all those, but it was really the presence of Jesus that kicked me over the edge. And I came into the church shortly after that.
Let me ask a question that's been building up here and several different things you said, and I'm going to try to tie together a couple strands here. Earlier in our discussion, you mentioned the dangers of congregational polity, how basically any crazy person could get a hold of the congregation and can go off in numerous different tangents. But we've also just talked about here the PCUSA, and you mentioned Catherine Jeffords Shorey and her election. It seems that from your vantage point, this could also be true of more Episcopal type of churches. Have you given any thought to why the Catholic Church maybe has not gone in that direction?
Well, I think that it's safe to say that that bishops, priests, entire educational institutions, close to entire religious orders, have gone that way.
Mm-hmm.
Georgetown University still has crosses hanging in the classrooms, and still talks about being a church in the Jesuit tradition. But it's. To say that Georgetown is a Catholic institution is kind of stretching the definition a little bit. And so you have had certainly individuals and whole institutions riding off the rails. What you can't have is the whole church riding off the rails. And, the definition of the Trinity, regardless of what, Father so-and-so wants to say, is not up for grabs. You can't get together in a church in a church meeting and take a vote and decide that the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit are optional. Despite the extraordinary synod that we had last month, marriage is not up for grabs in the Catholic Church. Sexuality is not up for grabs in the Catholic Church. These things, the way I put it, and I realize I'm being facetious, the Catholic Church has put its theology and its doctrine in the hands of the only people who can be trusted, that is, dead people.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
kind of as Chesterton put it, you know, tradition is the democracy of the dead. You know, why should we only allow people who happen to be alive right now have a vote when there are so many who have been faithful in the past who deserve a vote as well? And I mean, the extraordinary synod made a lot of people, and I think particularly people who've converted to the Catholic Church for this very reason, extremely nervous. Ross Douthat, writing in the New York Times, wrote a very nervous article about, you know, I came here because I was sick of these kinds of discussions. Let's get back to being Catholic. But the doctrine in the Catechism of the Catholic Church isn't going to change. And if Father Sunbeam wants to try to make it up to be something that it's not, he doesn't have the right to organize and change it. I mean, Catholics for Choice, now there's an organization that, there's no point in that organization existing. The church is not going to change its stand on abortion, period. Whereas, for example, the Presbyterian Church USA long ago got together and voted to change their position on birth control and abortion. The Catholic Church can't do that.
Some interesting observations, and this has really gotten me thinking about a number of institutional aspects, because I've always been curious about the institutional structure of the Catholic Church related to Protestant denominations. So a lot to think about there, but I do want to return us back to your conversion. And you got us to the point, sitting in that pew, of saying, okay, I'm moving over to the Catholic Church now. Your son had already done that. So it seems like a pathway in the family has already been opened there. How about your wife? Did you come home one day and say, "Hi, honey, we're going to be Catholics," or what was the deal there?
Well, you know, my wife is extremely intelligent, but my wife, the way she puts it, she says, "I've got the street smarts." My son and I are the philosophers, theologians in the family, and certainly I was sharing my journey and all of it with my wife. Right along, and she was the one who finally said, she said, "Look, why don't you just enter the Catholic Church?" I said, "What about you?" And she said, "You need to do it for you. Let me tread my own path in this." And so my wife has not entered the church. She often attends Mass with me. I occasionally attend the Anglican Church with her, she has not made the switch. Although my impression is that will happen. I think for her, and I think for a lot of people, there's just the speed bump of, wait a minute, I've been a Protestant all my life, I'm going to be a Catholic? What?
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like the Tiber is a very formidable barrier, whereas if you visit Rome, you realize that you can walk across it, you can wade across it. It's not much of a river, so she has not moved over into the Catholic Church yet.
That brings me specifically to the e-book, the online book that you've written called "How Not to Become a Catholic," which is an interesting title for somebody who did become a Catholic, and it deals with these speed bumps and these blocks in the road and the path to becoming a Catholic. It's a great read, by the way, and we will point people back to it because it has a very tongue-in-cheek, kind of humorous self-autobiography feel to it, but also kind of a self-help book aspect to it. So it's a blending of a lot of different genres here. Go through the list. You have, I think, about 9 or 10 different things not to do. Go ahead and discuss some of these on how not to become a Catholic. And
I think that, you know, so often within Protestant, particularly Protestant evangelical circles, you know, a question of the Assumption of Mary, the Immaculate Conception, the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist, purgatory will come. come up. And you'll get this response of, how can anybody believe that? Well, now wait a minute. Somebody does believe that. And, you know, it's what we were talking about earlier. There seems to be this tacit assumption that all Catholics must be idiots because their doctrines contradict one another. They contradict the clear meaning and reading of Scripture. How can this possibly be? And again, part of my journey, and whether you encounter them in books or whether you encounter them, as I have had the privilege to do in many cases, in person, there are some huge intellects in the Catholic Church. People who understand theology, who understand Bible, who understand culture, and there are very good reasons for believing in things like purgatory, the Immaculate Conception, and so on and so forth. And simply assume that Catholics are idiots for believing in that, again, my experience is you can't do that. I mean, that's intellectually dishonest in the final analysis. So, you know, and you can't pick and choose. You know, everybody's an idiot except John Paul II. Well, no, I mean, either everybody's an idiot or nobody's an idiot, or many people are not idiots.
Yeah, yeah.
Having met Catholic idiots, I.
You got to have the range of it, but yeah.
And with that, getting your information about the Catholic Church secondhand, the grandfather of one of my son's friends out in California was telling me that I don't know why we were on the subject. But he said, yeah, when I'm Catholic, and in the Catholic Church, we believe that when you die, you become an angel. And I'm like, no, actually, that's not what the Church teaches. Oh, no, I'm a Catholic. I that's what the Church teaches. I said, really, honestly, I'm not. He said, I'm born and brought up a Catholic. That's what the Church teaches. All right, you know, fine. So how about those 49ers? In fact, cartoons in The New Yorker and old Bugs Bunny funnies do teach that when you die, you become an angel. True enough.
Mm-hmm.
But the Catholic Church doesn't. And so you have if you talk to badly catechized Catholic neighbors, if you talk with people who, you know, quote, used to be Catholic, but now I'm a Christian, close quote, priests or religious, that were formed in the 1970s during what George Weigel has called the post-Vatican II silly season, you're going to get all sorts of misinformation. And if you get all that information secondhand, your worst fears about the Catholic Church will be realized. But if you take the time to read people like Scott Hahn, to read the Catechism or the shortened-down version of the Catechism, if you read a book like Mark Knoll's and Carolyn Nystrom's book, Is the Reformation Over? Knoll being a dyed-in-the-wool Protestant who was for years at Wheaton College and is now at Notre Dame, you'll get a very different view. In that book, Knoll and Nystrom say that any evangelical reading the Catechism of the Catholic Church, you know, will agree with, you know, 65-70% of it without any problem at all and benefit from reading it. So I think that's a real difficulty, is getting the information secondhand, and then assume that the Catholicism and the Bible don't mix. Catholics don't read the Bible. Well, you know, on Sunday at Mass, there's an Old Testament reading. We sing a psalm. We have a New Testament reading. We have a gospel reading. For longer than I've been a Catholic, I've been using the Liturgy of the Hours, the breviary, as my daily devotions. And this is the sort of the standard Catholic devotion that all priests and religious are supposed to use, and lots of lay people use as well. And, anyone using the hours prays through the Psalms every month. Goes through not every verse of the Scriptures, but basically you go through the Scriptures over the course of a year, and reading something from everywhere. And you know, it's just soaking in Scripture. Lectio Divina, the meditation on Scripture, that's a Catholic thing. And yet there's this idea that, you know, the Catholics and Bible don't mix. Now, should Catholics have more Bible studies and be encouraged more and more to read the Bible? Absolutely, they should be. But that's a pastoral issue. That's not a theological issue.
There's another one in your list, and we won't be able to cover the entire list, so we're going to turn people back to your book, How Not to Become a Catholic. It'll be linked on our website so everybody can find it. And again, as I mentioned, it's a really fun read. The other one that caught my attention was to affirm the great tradition, but don't ask what's in it. Tell us what that one is.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have that popping up in people's thinking now and then. The great tradition. Well, what's the great tradition? The great tradition is the tradition of the church fathers, the tradition of the fathers before Nicaea, at the Nicene Conference, and so on. And what it really means is, well, let me tell a story. When Francis Beckwith, professor at Baylor, and at the time was president of the Evangelical Theological Society, when Francis Beckwith went back to the Catholic Church, he was brought up Catholic, so all he needed to do was go to confession and receive the Eucharist. When Beckwith went back to the Catholic Church, there was a very conciliatory and kind column written about it in the blog for the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals, a Reformation 21 blog, by Dr. Truman, who is a professor at Westminster Theological Seminary in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, Carl Truman. And in it he says, I only believe the creeds of the church are only to be believed insofar as they continue to express what is written in the Scriptures. And I read that, and I was like, now, what can that possibly mean? And wouldn't Catherine Jeffer Shorey or other liberals completely agree with that? And who's to say suddenly that the creeds no longer accord with the Scriptures after, you know, 1,200 years? How does this work? And I think in order to have, you know, I'm getting my arguments all twisted up, but without the creeds, it seems to me that the creeds of the church, if I'm exegeting Scripture and I come to the conclusion, I look at it and say, gosh, look at that. Jesus really wasn't divine. Son of a gun. I don't go back and change the creed or throw the creed out. The creed comes over, whacks me on the back of the head and says, you idiot, you did it wrong.
Yeah.
You know, think this through again, because Jesus is divine. And it prevents me from that private judgment. So people want to hang on to the creeds because there are plenty of people who claim to believe the Scriptures, including, for example, Jehovah's Witnesses, who don't affirm things like the divinity of Christ and the doctrine of the Trinity. Well, the problem with going back to the great tradition is the great tradition includes the real presence of Jesus, body and blood, soul and divinity, in the sacrament. It includes the place that Mary has in Catholic theology, and certainly the Assumption of Mary, if not the Immaculate Conception. It includes prayers to the saints. It includes all kinds of things that Protestants don't want any part of. But that's all part of the great tradition. And the idea that you can go back there and cherry pick, well, I like this piece, but I don't like that piece, it seems to me to be problematic. I mean, you either say, I'm going to be guided by the great tradition, or I'm not. John Wesley famously said, in essentials unity, in unessentials diversity, in all things charity. Well, great, but is in so many things the devil's in the details. What's an essential? What's an unessential? How do you sort all those things out? And that's increasingly difficult today when being a welcoming church, meaning welcoming gays and lesbians and same-sex marriage and so on, for a lot of these denominations, or at least people within the denominations, has become an essential. And the doctrine of the Trinity has become an inessential. Who gets to decide? Where do they get to decide? And as one friend of mine finally said, he pointed to the great tradition. Let's go back to the creeds. Well, at that point, you're making a very Catholic argument because you're saying that the church has authority over how we interpret the scriptures. But that's a Catholic argument. That's no longer a Protestant argument.
Mm-hmm. There's a number of other points that you cover in your book, How Not to Become a Catholic. And again, I'm going to point people back to that book by linking it on our website. But we are running a little short on time here. And here's one question I want you to reflect on. You mentioned Marcus Grody a while back and something known as the Coming Home Network. I would like you to discuss what that is and in turn reflect upon whether you see over the next several years, decade or so, whether there will be an influx back into the Catholic Church. So a little bit of sociological reflection here on not only your journey, but perhaps the journey for society at large.
Marcus was a fellow student with me at Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary when we were getting our master's degrees. He was at Park Street Church when I was there, and we were friends. His story, he became a minister in the Presbyterian Church USA, and you can go to the Coming Home Network website and read his testimony about coming into the Catholic Church. And out of that, he created this ministry, this Coming Home Network, which was partly a support network, partly, in a sense, apologetics, for Protestant ministers coming into the Catholic Church. You know, somebody asked me, well, what did you lose by coming into the Catholic Church? What did you have to give up? And, you know, I was already, well, at that point, I was not even working for a nonprofit. I was working independently. I obviously gave up some status. Some people who didn't like me to begin with didn't like me even more within the evangelical world. There was a consulting contract that I was on that wasn't interested in having a Catholic fill that role. But I really didn't lose very much. My friends are still my friends. In fact, I was on the subway yesterday, met a guy from the Presbytery, and we had a marvelous conversation about what's going on and catching up with one another. So my friends are still my friends, and that's a good thing. Many Protestant ministers, particularly if they are serving a church, coming into the Catholic Church is chaos. Or if they're working for a parachurch ministry, where they've raised support and they're well established and to come into the Catholic Church is to throw their career out the window and throw their livelihood out the window. The Coming Home Network is a support network. And in a sense, a way to cushion the minister coming into the Catholic Church. At the same time, be an opportunity for people to tell their stories and draw people into the Catholic Church.
And then the second part of that question was: do you see more and more of this returning home or returning to the Catholic Church occurring in society? I mean, we dropped a number of large names along the way, but this happens to everyday folk all the time. And from your vantage point, are you seeing more and more of a movement toward the Catholic Church?
I think there's data. There have been some books written, one by the late Robert Weber, who was a theologian at Wheaton College, one by Colleen Carroll, looking at young people and their attraction to liturgical churches, to the Catholic Church, to the Orthodox Church, to the Anglican Church, and that's certainly a movement that is happening. That is going on. There's this sense of mystery. You even see it within some emerging churches where, you know, they're kind of going up in the church's attic and they're finding icons and They're finding icons. They're finding candles. And even though they're still Protestants, those things are showing up in their churches. So you're seeing that kind of a longing for what Weber used to call the, ancient modern church, and going back to the roots. I do fear that, it's already started to happen with evangelical churches, being swayed by the culture, particularly on issues of sexuality. Create people who are essentially find themselves as free agents and are looking for a home, and I think that it'll have the same effect on ministers. Certainly within the people who are Anglicans or former Episcopalians, the Pope Benedict set up a kind of a diocese without walls or without boundaries in the U.S. that uses the Anglican rite in a Catholic church, and that, I think, is a very attractive opportunity for people. So, yeah, I think that insofar as evangelicals can continue to keep private judgment, everyone does what is right in his own eyes under control, I think that there will still be that, but I think that the Catholic option of real authority, stemming within the Catholic understanding from Jesus appointing Peter essentially as the first pope and the succession from Peter, I think that there is a real sense where the Catholic Church becomes a very attractive option for people. And I know certainly that our parish has more than, it's 20 or so people coming into the church every Easter. I happened to be out of town this past Easter, and I could not believe the number of people who were baptized and received into the church at Easter Vigil at this parish down in Florida that I attended. In fact, it was like, how many people? it's like they're baptizing them one after another, and they had a pool. They were baptizing them by immersion. Hmm. And it was amazing. There must have been 40 or 50 people who entered the church. And so the numbers are substantial.
Well, some interesting trends to keep an eye on. Unfortunately, we didn't have a chance to talk about any of your thoughts on religious liberty, but we're going to have you back on the show to discuss that at some point in time. But my guest today has been Jim Tokowich. Jim, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.